My name is Donald Drew, and I'm leading a seminar on some thoughts on Solzhenitsyn. I'd like to begin by laying the foundations for questions and comment and discussion by giving a brief autobiography, a brief review of his life, biography, then some conclusions about his work. In a recent interview in The Times, London, last year, the distinguished Russian dissident historian Roy Medvedev recalled that when President Nixon came to Moscow in 1974, the KGB sealed off the homes of himself, Sakharov, and Solzhenitsyn. He added that today, I quote, "Solzhenitsyn is in Vermont, Sakharov is in Gorky, and most of the others are in prison or are silent," end of quote. He himself is again under observation permanently, but he will not give in because, as he said, "If I said, all right, I will not meet more foreigners, I will not write articles, I will just sit at home and write books, which will never be published," they would consider that a total victory. There is no concept of dialogue or compromise in our country. Either you make no concessions of any kind, or you give in completely. And I will not give in. Now, this somber, courageous attitude of mind has been Solzhenitsyn's also. He did not give in, and he will not give in. He's an international figure, a Nobel Prize winner for literature, commanding a worldwide audience. The United States has made him an honorary citizen. His writings are avidly seized on and read widely in the West, secretly in the East. He is a crafted litterateur, a meticulous historian, a seer and prophet, and a man of well above the average integrity, fortitude, and intelligence. I wish to point out, it must be said of him as of, say, a man like Lewis, he is not a Christian writer. He is a writer who happens to be a Christian now, but whose early work was written when he was a communist. He was born 66 years ago, of poor middle-class parents, and following university, where he read mathematics and physics, became a physics teacher. During the Second World War, he fought on the Leningrad front as the commander of an artillery battery and was twice decorated. But he was arrested in early 1945 for criticizing Stalin in a letter to a friend in which he had referred to Stalin as a ringleader of thieves, a betrayer of Leninism, and responsible for the army's unpreparedness and defeats at the beginning of the war. As a result, he spent 7 years in various prisons and camps, followed by exile in the province of Kazakhstan, where he taught mathematics in a school. While in a labor camp, Solzhenitsyn had developed cancer, which now became acute, and he was successfully treated for this in Tashkent, and there has been no recurrence so far. In February 1956, the military section of the Supreme Court reviewed his case, announcing that there was no substance in the original charges and that all action with regard to his sentence should cease. This was, you remember, in the climate of Khrushchev. He settled 100 miles south of Moscow with his wife and family, but by 1970 his marriage had broken down and he was eventually divorced. While at school, as a boy, he'd always been ambitious to be a writer, and after his exile he began to write. 4 novellas, some plays and poems, and various articles denied him the Lenin Prize for Literature, but secured him the attention of the KGB and his expulsion from the Union of Writers. Much of his work was now available in the West, and in October 1970 he was awarded the Nobel Prize, but not allowed to leave the country to receive it. And ever since his return from exile, and especially after his work began to appear in the USSR, first in Samizdat and then a little of it openly, Solzhenitsyn has become the object of constant observation, harassment, and threats. Early in 73, he married his present wife, but September of that year saw the beginning of the process that was to lead to his expulsion in February of the following year from the Soviet Union. The existence of the manuscript of the Gulag Archipelago had been known in the West since 69, but Solzhenitsyn had successfully concealed it from the KGB, but that month they learned that one of his former assistants had hidden a copy in Leningrad, and after 5 days of interrogation, she revealed its place of concealment and hanged herself. Solzhenitsyn had refrained from publishing the Gulag because some people mentioned in it were still living and would suffer reprisals, but now he saw no reason for withholding its publication, and the first parts appeared in Paris that December. He was immediately viciously attacked in the Soviet media, summoned twice to the state prosecutor's office, which he each time refused, but was arrested, taken to prison, put into prisoner's uniform, and charged with treason. He'd anticipated arrest, and in a brave statement declared incompetent any court appointed to try him, that he would answer no questions, and if forcibly imprisoned, would not work for one half hour for his captors. He was informed the next day that by decree of the Supreme Soviet, he was to be deprived of his citizenship and deported. Within hours, he was in West Germany, later settling in Zurich, where his wife and three children joined him in March 74. They all now live in Vermont in the United States. Since his deportation, he has not fundamentally changed his way of life, and the center of that life is his literary work, and then the cause of civil liberty in the Soviet Union. He frequently writes letters in support of persecuted authors and has established a fund from his royalties to assist the families of dissidents in the USSR. So much for a very brief biography of the man. May I read first, just endorsing what was said about his refusal to attend, to the, this is what he writes to the Minister of State Security, who was then Yuri Andropov. For many years, I have borne in silence the lawlessness of your employees, the inspection of all my correspondence, the confiscation of half of it, the tracking down of my correspondence, their persecution at work, the spying around my house, the shadowing of visitors, the tapping of telephone conversations, the drilling of holes in ceilings, the placing of recording apparatus in my city flat and at my Dhaka, and a persistent slander campaign against me. But after the raid yesterday, I will no longer be silent. He then writes to the chairman of the Council of Ministers, Alexei Kosygin. I enclose a copy of my letter to the Minister of State Security. I consider him personally responsible for all the illegalities mentioned. If the government of the USSR does not approve of these actions of Minister Andropov, I shall expect an investigation into the matter. The man's courage is beyond praise. Here's another brief letter to the Office of the Public Prosecutor in reply to its repeated summons. I refuse to acknowledge the legality of your summons and shall not report for questioning to any government agency. Before requiring citizens to observe the law, you must learn to carry it out yourselves. Set free the innocent people now imprisoned. Punish those responsible for mass extermination and the false informers. Punish the administrators and the special squads who carried out the policy of genocide. This very day, deprive the local and departmental satraps of their unlimited power over citizens. Their arbitrary use of courts and psychiatrists satisfy the millions of lawful but suppressed complaints. If such proceedings are taken against me, I will not go to the court on my own two legs. I shall have to be delivered with my hands bound and in a black mariah. I shall not answer a single question put by such a court. If I am sentenced to imprisonment, I shall submit only to the sentence in handcuffs. And in confinement, I, who have already given the 8 best years of my life to forced labour for the state and by way of wages contracted cancer, will never do another half hour's work for the oppressors. Alexander Solzhenitsyn. So much for brief biography and for an expression of the tremendous courage of this man. His chief interests now are his literary work, particularly his work as an historian. It is his intention. He wants to write the true history of the Russian Revolution. He's interested also in civil liberties in the USSR and has a passionate concern for his country and for those liberties and for Christian and Jewish and other dissidents. Now, his literary work may be divided into 7 sections: short stories or novellas, plays, poems, novels, histories, polemical works, and letters. In the polemical work, The Oak and the Calf, that book is essential, and it shows his desperate struggle as a man and a writer before his deportation. It contains hundreds of letters received by him, written by him, concerning his harassment and persecution and that of his family. He shows how his novels and The Gulag were written in samizdat, smuggled abroad, and the letters of great courage to ministers and officials. The Russian literary tradition, there the writer provides guidance and wise comment on the problems of his day. Solzhenitsyn likewise does, and he attacked socialist realism writing. He writes of camps, prisons, bureaucracy, petty officialdom, and you can tell, one can tell so clearly that he is in the Russian literary tradition, not the USSR literary tradition, the Russian tradition where there is great love and compassion for the handicapped, the weak and the downtrodden, where there's great sensitivity to suffering, and this comes out in all his writing. His plays, just a brief word, two plays, Incident at a Station, and I can't remember the name of the station, it's an unpronounceable Russian name. But I'd like to draw your attention to his play called The Love Girl and the Innocent, which is about a prison camp, and of course he draws all this from his own experience. And in this play, on the stage, the front of the stage, there are watchtowers with actors dressed in the uniform of military and KGB people with guns in the watchtowers. At the exits and entrances there are also KGB people and soldiers with guns. And during the performance there are these people with their guns drawn walking slowly up and down the aisles looking at the audience. The exits are barred at the interval and then people are let out. But the climax comes when at the end of the performance everybody gets up, the soldiers bark at them, shout at them, and tell them to sit down, and some are cowed and do so. Others remain standing, and then eventually people move out their seats into the aisles, but are not allowed to leave the theatre. And quietly, ultimately, all the talking ceases, and after about 5 minutes, they suddenly realise there's no sound. This is what it's like to be in prison. And the experience has got right home to them. And this audience participation was done in 1954 when that play was written. And nothing like it had been seen. Now his history is trying to establish the truth of Russia's early revolutionary years. And he regards the accurate writing of this as the chief calling of his literary life. And he's engaged in writing volumes following August 1914 in that series. He rejects the Marxian view of history and also Tolstoy's view that the laws of history can never be known. He makes people responsible for their choices and for the consequences of their choices. He also, in his histories, destroys the myth of a constructive, humane Lenin and shows that he initiated the extra-legal procedures and legitimized the secret police and camps, but that Stalin perfected them. Also, he talks about the altering of history to show the party that is right. One remembers, one recalls the latest film, The Killing Fields, in which a leading member of the Khmer Rouge actually did say this. This is the year zero, and nothing has existed before. The Gulag history is stark and terrifying. Threats on his life, and of course, when it appeared, the party panicked. Because he had forced the nation, his readers, only those who knew of him, to face up to the national capacity for sin and the individual responsibility, an act that could dilute nationalism and patriotism that provides such an essential part of the regime's legitimacy. He also exposed Stalin, among others, and exposed the falsification of history. He showed Lenin as the author of the terror. And he shows that nations, like individuals, do not advance morally until they've confessed their invalid and evil past. He reminds one of modern Germany. Chancellor Adenauer, immediately after the war, was the first one to say, "We have to repent of the terrible crimes committed by the Nazis." And various other German leaders have said similar things. He makes us in the histories. Also ask the question, what is really meant by these words used so glibly, good, evil, responsibility, freedom, justice, crime? When asked, is it not better to be red than dead? Solzhenitsyn's reply is always, it's better to be dead than a scoundrel, because he exposes the dangers to the West from communism and the naivety of the West and the dangers of that system against a world opposed to it with comparative freedoms. Now, what are his achievements? He's a great patriot. He's not a nationalist, he's a patriot and a lover of Mother Russia. His passionate devotion, he has a passionate devotion to unmasking the lie, to denouncing the lie and proclaiming the truth. He attacks, as all men do with any vision, and who are great writers, men like C.S. Lewis and T.S. Eliot, among others. He attacks scientism and materialism, both the philosophy and the unnecessary possessions. He sees himself as speaking as the conscience of his nation, in the tradition of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. He's much concerned about the Russian Orthodox Church, and denounces its pusillanimity, its timidity and compromise. He distinguishes, and constantly makes this distinction, between Russia and the USSR. And he regards Russia as having been taken over by gangsters. He's prepared to die for the truth, and he rejects the language of Soviet realism, socialist realism, of propaganda, and has revitalized Russian and peasant speech, which he heard so much in the prison camps, idiomatic Russian. He sees Christianity as the only force for spiritual healing of Russia, and has a distinctively biblical worldview. He challenges all the assumptions of progress and sees it as progressivism. And he knows and says that evil is real in men and the world, and its origin is Satan. He also sees the Russian Orthodox Church as possibly the savior of Russia. And he criticizes the UN and superficial internationalism. He loves his people. His whole life is summed up in the phrase, "Nobody can bar the road to truth. I am prepared to die for its advance." Now, his present position is, because of his criticism of the West, as well as the East, criticism of the West directed to its materialism and hedonism, as well as to its, generally speaking, weak and unrealistic attitude to the East, and because of his not having become a pawn of the USA Eastern establishment, and because of his espousing freedom, but having little faith in democracy, and espousing a benevolent oligarchy supported by the Russian Orthodox Church, because of all these reasons, he is ignored by the media. And because he's no longer news, he's no longer important. But as we know, the media is concerned, and indeed it has to be concerned, it's its job, with what is new. Solzhenitsyn is concerned with what is true. And he can the more readily pursue his historical studies and speak about his historical studies. He has a naive view, it seems to me, of the role of the Russian Orthodox Church. This view is scorned by Roy and Zorev Medvedev and by Sekharov and other dissidents. His view of the role of the Russian Orthodox Church is something like this. He believes that the West can exert pressure, constant pressure, and must keep on doing so, on the USSR, but he believes also that before Russia will ever be liberated, the liberation will come from within. How he envisages this is not clear. Millions of people in Russia have never heard of him. I'm sure there are millions who have. Certainly all people who can read and who've been able to get hold of the Samizdat and maybe his novel One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich will have heard of him. But there are millions in Russia, in the USSR, who haven't heard of him. But his belief is that there will be a revival through the Russian Orthodox Church and through dissatisfaction and through the many, many cracks that are to be found in the army and between the services as well as within them, and of course huge cracks in the Politburo and in the economy, a desperate economy. He believes that the monolithic facade that appears to be so monolithic, so single and unified, and so full of menace, is riddled with weakness. And that if the West keeps on exerting pressure of all kinds, economic and other kinds, moral pressure, there will take place. It'll be a climate of opinion will be generated for a revitalized the ending of the USSR and the re-beginning of a new Russia. Now, the perhaps the more realistic, I don't know whether to call them that, Russians, such as those I mentioned, Sakharov and the two and the Medvedev brothers, believe that it will come only from outside. There'll be pressure from outside, and they hope for a disintegration of the economy. But they have to be careful, of course, what they say, you know, because their lives are on the line all the time, and they're under house arrest and so on.